Welcome to the AI Events Podcast, where you will find conversations hosted by AI scholars featuring prominent thinkers and leaders discussing the most important ideas. Here at AI, we welcome and value the competition of ideas, so our scholars invite smart people with a wide range of job descriptions, areas of study, political affiliations, and points of view to come and discuss how we can arrive at the best solutions for a better, freer, and safer world.
Welcome to the American Enterprise Institute. My name is Ryan Streeter. I'm the Director of Domestic Policy Studies here at AEI, and it's my pleasure to welcome you this morning for this event on localism and social capital and the role of federalism in restoring civic connectedness in America. We're really pleased to be joined by Senator Mike Lee and a distinguished group of panelists to talk about these issues today. And we will, after the Senator's remarks, allow a few minutes for questions that you can ask of the senator before he has to depart, and then we'll welcome our panelists up for their discussion, and that will also be followed by a Q&A. Just a couple of ground rules here for our Q&As here at AEI. We just ask that you be concise and that you ask questions rather than deliver statements, and when you're called on, just say your name and your affiliation if you have one. So I'm really, really pleased to be able to welcome Senator Mike Lee to the podium today. Senator Lee was elected to serve the state of Utah in the U.S. Senate in 2010, and prior to the election, practiced law in the private sector, and has a distinguished career of public service as well that includes roles as assistant U.S. attorney. He served as the general counsel to Governor John Huntsman in Utah, and also clerked for now Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito in the Third Circuit. So I'm really pleased to welcome him to the dais today. I think in his role as the vice chairman of the Joint Economic Committee, it was just one of his several committee assignments, he has launched an ambitious project called the Social Capital Project, which is aimed at looking at civic connectedness in America, looking at associational life, assessing the strength and quality of civic connectedness, where it's declining and why, and what we can do about it. And so I'd like you to join me in welcoming Senator Mike Lee to the stage here at AEI. Senator, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all of you for being here. It's always a pleasure to be at AEI. It's especially heartwarming to be able to speak about two of my favorite things, social connectedness and federalism, and have people actually show up at 8:30 a.m. on a Wednesday when people have a lot of perfectly other good things to do. So thank you for being here. I'm honored to talk about localism, also with such thoughtful scholars. Yuval, Lee, Joel, and Scott, I of course expect you back at the office within 15 minutes after your panel is finished. The other week, I stumbled across something interesting that I think illustrates some of the challenges facing communities in America today. It was from CNBC, and paraphrasing Mark Zuckerberg, CNBC reported, Facebook can play a role that churches and Little League once filled. Zuckerberg was, of course, celebrating an important milestone for his social media platform. It now has 2 billion monthly users. But I was struck by how he described those users in his speech, which was titled Bringing the World Closer Together. He called the Facebook user base a community that happens to be 2 billion users strong. As Silicon Valley lingo goes, this term is not that objectionable, and the use of this term in this circumstance isn't that strange. In fact, it's kind of endearing. It speaks to a deep-seated recognition that community is good, and that man was not meant to live alone. But words do matter, and a group of 2 billion people is not really a community in any meaningful sense of that word. 2 billion people isn't even a mass movement. In the year 1930, it was the total population of the planet we occupied. It doesn't make sense to describe 2 billion people as a community because a community is all about a collection of human interpersonal relationships. And you can only have so many of those. As they say, if everyone is family, no one is. In fact, the limited nature of community is one of the reasons community is so very valuable. Membership in a community helps to make the impersonal mass society in which we live much more manageable and ultimately much more human. And so while Facebook can help connect us with friends and family and cat videos, it's not a true community. Community institutions like churches and like little leagues can't be replaced by the glowing rectangles that we keep in our pockets that we sometimes seem to check obsessively. Rather, community is the stage where we perform the most rewarding roles in our lives, as children and parents, as siblings, as spouses, as friends, as mentors, and disciples. Strong communities surround us with the supporting cast members, each of whom can help us in those roles. Moreover, they prepare young people to take on these challenging roles as they grow. Strong communities instruct us in our early years, and they support us thereafter. Weak communities, by contrast, are something of an empty stage where individuals perform in the glare of the spotlight, forced to improvise their roles without accompaniment and without support. Which leads to a very important question: how strong are America's communities today? Recently, we started a multi-year research effort within the Joint Economic Committee called the Social Capital Project to study this very question. In May of this year, we released our first report titled What We Do Together: The State of Associational Life in America. Drawing on decades of social science research, the report found that American communities are growing weaker. Now, here's some of what we found. This will not come as a surprise to many of you, but American families look quite different than they did just a few decades ago. And in many respects, American families are worse off. Men and women are having fewer children in total, and they're also having fewer children within wedlock. Between 1970 and 2015, births to single mothers rose from 11% of all births to 40%. A majority of American children can now expect to live with just one parent at some point during their lives. Americans are spending less time in religious communities, which Robert Putnam called, quote, the single most important repository of social capital in America. Church attendance and trust in organized religion have dropped sharply since the 1970s. Americans also are participating a lot less in secular voluntary associations, such as Boy Scouts and Rotary International, groups that historically have brought Americans together from all different walks of life. And we increasingly are finding ourselves segregated on the basis of class or at least some type of socioeconomic status. As AEI's own Charles Murray has pointed out, upper middle class professionals have insulated themselves from their fellow countrymen by moving into neighborhoods of immense privilege. It should surprise no one that the largest cluster of these affluent neighborhoods can be found right in and around Washington, D.C. The Social Capital Project's report paints a concerning picture of American community life. It finds that strong communities increasingly are a class prerogative rather than a common inheritance, one that people can reliably expect to have in their lives. The destruction of community life is a spiritual crisis for millions of our fellow citizens. These Americans live among their neighbors, but living among them in this case doesn't necessarily mean living with them. They've been severed from local institutions that give meaning and purpose to the human soul, and that affect, if we allow them to, our lives in a very real personal way. So what caused this? Where did this come from? Why did it happen? There are, of course, a lot of culprits. But I contend that much of the blame goes, like many other things, to the government. which has intruded into aspects of life that used to be the sole domain of Americans' robust institutions of civil society. It's no coincidence that federal power has expanded at exactly the same time that American communities have started to come apart. The trends are related, and in fact, they tend to reinforce one another. When government grows, civil society recedes. When government flexes its muscle, the muscle of civil society tends inevitably to atrophy. Just to give one recent example, according to AEI researcher Bradford Wilcox, almost one-third of Americans report that they personally know someone who has not gotten married for fear of losing a means-tested government benefit. Think about what that means, that your relationship with an impersonal, massive government entity would cause you to change a decision about something as important as that. So government welfare policy is discouraging marriage, which is the bedrock of healthy societies, not to mention upward mobility and the pursuit of happiness, not to mention that it's one of the greatest sources of happiness for human beings throughout Earth. Government crowds out civic groups by competing with them to perform similar social functions, to perform functions once provided by institutions of civil society. Robbed of purpose by a competitor that they cannot outspend, that they can't really compete with in many respects, these civic groups start to wither, leaving behind an empty public square. This in turn provides yet another pretext for state intervention, and so government expands again, fueled by the dead timber of civil society. The timber, having been killed and then dried out, is just fuel to keep that fire burning. We observed this in the early 20th century with the decline of a number of fraternal societies, groups that provided their mostly working class members with everything from life insurance to companionship to health care. The welfare state supplanted these local lodges over a few decades. As one member wrote, his order, quote, lost a strong argument for recruiting members when the government started providing very similar services. But government does not just compete with civil society in the material realm through the provision of welfare. It competes also in the spiritual realm by offering individuals alternative visions of community, political identities that tend to bypass local affections. As the great scholar Robert Nisbet observed, men and women hunger for community, and they will go looking for it when they do not find it in any place that's close to home. Nisbet noted that for many people, quote, this same quest terminates in the political party or action group. We can see this today in national protest movements that are reacting to the centralized, winner-take-all nature of federal elections and of federal policymaking. These mass movements give participants the feelings we sometimes associate with community, namely a sense of belonging, a sense of purpose, a sense of deeply rooted meaning. But they instill these feelings on the cheap. Attending marches, signing petitions, and posting indignantly on Facebook are no substitute for the hard work of building real communities in our real lives with real other human beings who we actually know. Putnam perhaps said it best, quote, from the point of view of social connectedness, the Environmental Defense Fund and a bowling league are just not in the same category, close quote. Mass movements are designed to affect change at the highest levels of government, but they're ill-suited for the human-sized problems of everyday life. They do not take care of the neighborhood kids during a family emergency. They do not bring groceries to the shut-in down the street. And so when partisans leave their rallies, they often return to communities as barren and as inhospitable as before, whether they're wearing Make America Great Again hats or some type of pink knit hat. America is investing its energy in national politics, and in many cases, little more than commentary about national politics, even as it's withdrawing from its local communities where citizens' power to create change is of orders of magnitude greater. Most social media activism, hurling hashtags and retweeting insults from late-night comedians, is not in fact real engagement. It's like fantasy football. It borrows some data points. It borrows from some of the entertaining superficialities of the real thing, but without the stakes, without the sacrifices, without the genuine teamwork and the true rewards of the human endeavor. The challenge we face today is rebuilding our real communities, which will require us to reverse a century-old trend toward centralization. We need to turn our gaze away from Washington, D.C., back to where we came from, back from our starting point, a starting point in which robust institutions of civil society were not only the norm, but also formed the bedrock of who we are. If we accept the premise that improving the lives of our neighbors and of our neighborhoods is someone else's problem, some politician, some bureaucrat far off in Washington, D.C., then the battle is already lost. That's not to say government plays no role, or even necessarily a small role. Rather, it's to recognize that government only works in America as the people's servant and not as our master. This is a daunting challenge that certainly doesn't admit of easy solutions. A commitment to localism will require hard work. In the short run, it'll seem less emotionally satisfying than the status quo. The stakes may well seem smaller, the reforms less sweeping and less urgent, the opposition less villainous. But this is also why, unlike our current season of outrage, a turn toward localism stands a chance of actually succeeding, of yielding a happier, healthier republic. Put another way, I believe that if we aim for subsidiarity, we'll get positive change not only in City Hall, but in Washington, too. If we continue to aim instead for centralization, we will get neither. Let me explain why. First of all, a renewed focus on local governance would lower the stakes of political conflict in a very refreshing and necessary way. Everyone in this room is aware of the toxic kind of partisanship that we have seen in this country in the last few years. Our national politics resembles a tribal feud, with Hatfields and McCoys nursing ancient grudges against one another. Each new transgression is defended by invoking old transgressions by the rival clan. This is not what American politics is supposed to be about. It's not how we should view and treat our fellow beings, especially our fellow American citizens. The American system was carefully designed to avoid this sort of thing, to accommodate our differences, not pit them against one another in a sort of cage match. Peaceful accommodation would be possible once again if we returned to the state and local levels. Decisions made at lower levels of government are more likely to be consensus decisions, given the shared values within most communities. When problems arise within communities, local politicians are better situated to hear the concerns of those affected by their decisions, of their voters, of their stakeholders. Their accountability is positive, both for politicians who can make better informed judgments and for citizens who can have a more direct stake in the concerns they're raising and a more direct channel to communicate those concerns to elected officials. And we should not discount the sheer civilizing effect that proximity tends to have. As Alexis de Tocqueville wrote, quote, "The passions that commonly embroil society change their character when they find a vent so near the domestic hearth and the family circle," close quote. In other words, we can get away with shouting at our opponents in all kinds of caps on Twitter, but living in a community with others matters. And it, in particular, requires good manners. This is important, and this is something from which we can all benefit today. A renewed focus on local governance should also encourage innovation and public policy. States are referred to as laboratories of democracy, but often they're not free to experiment with policy solutions because the federal government imposes one solution from above, leaving them not laboratories, but lab rats themselves being tested upon by a federal overseer. This is a very risky way to make policy. Top-down solutions are an all-or-nothing bet of sorts, with catastrophic results for millions in the case of failure. Federalism offers a better way here as well. It offers states the opportunity to tailor policies to their diverse residents and to their respective cultures. Take my home state of Utah, for example. You may not know it, but Utah has had success in alleviating poverty while maintaining a small, conservative state government. The state spends little per capita on public welfare, yet its largest population center has the highest level of economic mobility in the country. 10.8% of Salt Lake City children born into the bottom quintile of the economic ladder will rise to the top quintile within their lifetimes. This impressive rate rivals the economic mobility of Denmark, which is often pointed to as the model of big government policies. Utah has accomplished this feat by understanding its unique strengths and its limitations. Thanks in large part to oppressive federal land policies, Utah has comparatively low fiscal capacity, which means it would have to levy painfully high taxes in order to fund big government programs. On the other hand, Utah is blessed with tight-knit communities. These communities are communities that tend in many cases to be oriented around the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, whose moral instruction and charitable network help low-income members become self-sufficient. Utah's success in fighting poverty may not be something that can be replicated easily in other states, but honest observers would conclude that it's found a responsible small government strategy that meets our needs. Other states should be free to try different policies and to learn about what works and what doesn't work from their neighbors. I certainly hope more states look to Utah as a model for responsible leadership, as a model for maintaining vibrant communities. But there's one more reason why we need a renewed commitment to local governance in America. It has to do with something at the very core of our national project, self-government. Earlier, I mentioned the anger that's fueling so much of American politics today. On the left and right, populist movements are marching on Washington, demanding change. Many of their members are motivated by a sense of loss. They do not think their leaders care about them or that their concerns are being taken seriously. Crucially, they do not feel like they are in control of their own government. Rather, they feel like their government is in control of them. This only fuels the fire. This loss of control is an indignity, a reversal of the American social compact, which puts the people in charge. And it began with the decline of self-governing local communities that give meaningful roles to ordinary men and women. Seen in this light, localism is a way to restore dignity to the forgotten Americans, to our fellow citizens who haven't caught every break or maybe never will, but who are devoted parents, who are trusted neighbors, and who are strong pillars within their respected communities. As usual, Tocqueville put it best. He wrote that, quote, "The township at the center of the ordinary relations of life serves as a field for the desire of public esteem," close quote. Alexis de Tocqueville understood that men and women desire esteem, and that for the vast majority of people, esteem is earned close to home, and it's earned through service to others close to home. That is the true beauty of localism. Hundreds of years after the founding, it still offers our country the best way forward. Thank you for having me here today. I look forward to hearing from the panelists and to learning what they have to say about this very important topic. Thanks a lot.
thank you for your remarks, Senator. And we, again, really appreciate you being here with us today, because we've heard there are a few things going on in the Senate right now. So we appreciate the time. And we know that your time is limited. So we have time for just a question or two. Just please wait for the mic to be passed to you. And again, state your name and your affiliation, and keep your questions brief if you can. Please, right back here in the blue coat.
Thank you, Senator Lee, for taking time out of your busy schedule to come speak to us. My name is Dalton Booker. I'm a program associate at the Osgood Center for International Studies. And you spoke a lot about the welfare state. And my question is, how do we balance, you know, what I do somewhat agree is an overuse of government intervention with the idea that a government's responsibility is to care for its people? And how can we do that effectively at the federal level without, as you said, choking out civil society?
This fits right into much of what I've been talking about, which is whenever we ask about government and about the role of government, we ought to start with the question, which government? Which government is it that ought to be most focused on that, most engaged on that issue? When we look to our own Constitution and we identify those things that 230 years ago, our founding fathers decided ought to be part of the responsibility of the federal government, we see things that are distinctively, unavoidably, necessarily national. Things like providing for our national defense, declaring war, establishing a uniform system of weights and measures, protecting trademarks, copyrights, and patents, regulating trade between the states with foreign nations and with Indian tribes. Once we get very far afield from those powers and the other powers outlined in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, we are in an area that not just by operation of the body of the original Constitution, and not just by operation of the 10th Amendment, ought to be handled at the state and local level, but also as a matter of practicality, are probably better suited for states and local governments. There are immense differences. There is immense diversity among our 50 states. Diversity not just demographically, economically, socially, educationally, but also in terms of the geography, the distribution of the population, how welfare benefits can be administered. And those things don't lend themselves well, to say nothing of the constitutional question I raised earlier, they don't lend themselves well to a one-size-fits-all tool administered from our nation's capital.
Okay, let's go to the far side of the room here.
Hi, I'm Howard Husick from the Manhattan Institute. The federal government does a good deal, as you know, in the name of aiding local communities. I think here, for instance, of the Community Development Block Grant, which HUD distributes to help localities. Some say it comes with strings that tells those localities what to do. Should the federal government, Secretary Carson has proposed actually to significantly reduce Community Development Block Grants, were those a good idea in the first place, and should they be continued?
You're exactly right in pointing out that increasingly I'm hearing complaints about recipients of community development block grants being told, unless you alter your policies in areas A, B, C, D, and E, you're not going to get these. For example, I've heard from some local governments in Utah that they're being told that unless they adopt the affirmatively furthering fair housing policies, they'll have some of their CDBGs stripped. So this does beg the question of whether this sort of thing is inevitable in the first place. I understand why they were put in place. I don't think that the Community Development Block Grant is something that couldn't be replicated on a state and local level and replicated with a lot more respect to the autonomy of the individual community at stake. And so, yeah, I think this is one of many things that we could look to as something that could function just as well and probably a whole lot better at the state level than at the federal level.
Okay, we have time for just one more quick question here, and I'll go right here in the middle.
Good morning, Senator. Thank you so much for being here. I'm Laura Thompson, and I'm with Service Year Alliance. I'm wondering how you think that national service, so programs like AmeriCorps, can play into bringing communities together and strengthening kind of this community fiber that you're talking about.
You know, I think anything that can channel people's civic-minded instincts can be a good thing. The more you connect things like that, however, with the federal government, I worry that you might choke out truly private sector voluntarism that springs to life organically through institutions of civil society. It's not to say that we shouldn't have anything like that with any government involvement, but given that we have been erring for the better part of a century on the side of more government involvement rather than less, and given the effect that it seems to have had on civil society, I would rather see us recede rather than aggress in that area.
Well, that's all the time we have for this segment. And Senator, again, thank you for your service to your state and the country and for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us today. Please join me again in thanking the Senator. All right, so if I could welcome our panelists up, I'll do some brief introductions and let them take the discussion from here. And again, we'll leave some time at the end of this discussion for questions as well. We are honored to be joined by a distinguished group this morning. I know that all of them are familiar to, if not all of you, a good many of you, and I'm just pleased that we got them all together in one place at the same time. We are joined on the far end of the, to my right, the table by Yuval Levin. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Very, way far to the right of me, hardly. Yuval Levin is the Hertog Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and known to a good many of us as the editor of National Affairs, which is read with great devotion by all of us here at AEI, and I'm sure a lot of you in the room. He's most recently authored the book, The Fractured Republic: Renewing America's Social Contract in the Age of Individualism, which, as those of you who've read the book know, gets into the themes we're here to discuss today. To his left, physically and probably philosophically, is Lee Drutman, a senior fellow in the Program on Political Reform at New America. Lee is the author of The Business of America's Lobbying and the winner of the 2016 American Political Science Association's Robert A. Dahl Award. And has just put out a much widely discussed paper recently on political ideology in the last election. Thanks for being here with us, Lee. Next is Scott Winship. Scott is the director of the Social Capital Project that the Senator was here talking with us about today, and is known to many of you as an expert on poverty and inequality and social mobility, and he's testified numerous times in Congress on those topics. He has served as the Walter Wriston Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and previously to that at the Brookings Institution just down the street. And finally, our moderator today is Joel Kotkin, the Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University in California, and the Executive Director of the Center for Opportunity Urbanism, which is based in Houston. Joel is known to many of you as the author of best-selling books, including The New Class Conflict and The City, A Global History. And he's a regular contributor to The Daily Beast, Real Clear Politics, and the Orange County Register. So please join me in welcoming our panelists today to AEI. And Joel, I'll just turn it over to you to begin the discussion.
Being here. What I'd like to do is give each of our panelists a chance to about 5 minutes, maybe react a little bit to the Senator's remarks, and then I may have some other questions. Then we will turn it over to the audience. So do you want to start at the extreme right?
All right. Well, thank you, first of all, to AEI for doing this, for bringing us together, for bringing Senator Lee here. I think his remarks covered the field very nicely and got at some of the points that would normally come up in this kind of conversation, the way in which government might crowd out civil society, the way in which decentralization might lower the temperature a little bit, the way in which it might allow for experimentation and policy, and ultimately toward the end there also how it might bring us together as a country. These are quite different points. They're very different arguments for localism. In some ways they're, I think, in tension with one another. What I was most struck by was the last point, which I think has got to be something that is high on the minds of anybody who thinks about the question of decentralization and localism now, which is, does this advance the cause of national unity, which we're so short of now, and which also is, in some ways, such a big political question now, the very idea of how we can be more unified. I think one way to understand the last election is as a debate that divided us over the question of how we ought best to unify the country. And it featured very different ways of thinking about how that might work. The question of localism is, I think, naturally complicated on that front. Localism is a way to allow distinctions to matter. It's a way to decentralize, and so you might think that it's a way to let communities go their own way and undermine unity and even civic engagement. But I do think that the key on that subject is to begin from the question that people involved in public policy always should ask themselves, which is compared to what? And certainly if the alternative to a turn to localism were a unified and cohesive national polity, then you'd have to say that localism might undermine unity and civic engagement. But in the lives of too many Americans now, the alternative is not national engagement, but loneliness and isolation and radical individualism. And a more decentralized politics, as I think Senator Lee started to get at, can work to draw people out of their narrow circles and into the public arena, toward a common space where people can see each other face to face, where not every question has to be an all or nothing abstraction, but where things can be more practical. And in that sense, can bring us into the public square in a way that can advance national unity. National unity requires a set of skills, a set of practices, a set of habits. And you know, people who talk about localism like to use Edmund Burke's term, reference to the little platoons. That we ought to think of ourselves as belonging to these little units of society. But we don't often enough read to the end of the sentence. What Burke had in mind by the little platoons, he said, to be attached to the subdivision, to love the little platoon we belong to in society, is the first principle, the germ, as it were, of public affections. It is the first link in the series by which we proceed toward a love of our country and of mankind. I think that first step is now too often skipped. And that first link in the chain that leads to love of country and of mankind is too often missing, and localism would certainly play a very important part in allowing us to revive it.
All right, well, thanks to AEI for having us here. I'm really excited to be here with my distinguished panelists. And this question of national unity, this question of the temperature of our politics and the way in which our winner-take-all national centralizing institutions have really fostered this intense conflict, I think these are the fundamental challenges that we have to deal with as a nation. If we're at our throats and demonizing each other and treating each other not as fellow citizens but as enemies, there is no national unity. So the challenge is how do we think about this? Now, I mean, let's face reality: is we are an incredibly divided country. A lot of that division is geographical, but it's also cultural. It's also values laden, and you know, starting in the 1960s, we've had really two very different visions of what America ought to be, increasingly pulling apart. We've had one vision that's really centered in the urban cosmopolitan environments, that's socially progressive, very sort of internationalist minded, embracing of all kinds of diversity, very secular, and that's one vision of America. And then we had another vision of America that's really rooted in traditions, in faith, in small town life, that is posits a very different vision of America. And those visions have come to capture our two political parties. And because we are so divided by these visions, we don't know people who have a different vision, we come to demonize each other. Now, the question, and I think this is the question that we ought to be wrestling with, is how much of this sort of intense, bitter, polarized conflict is a function of the sort of winner-take-all centralized power that is in our national institutions. This is something that Donald Trump said during the campaign. He said, if I don't win, I think this will be the last election that Republicans have a chance, because you're going to have people flowing across the border, you're going to have illegal immigrants coming in, and they're going to be legalized and vote. And once that happens, you can forget it, right? I mean, it's this idea that if what happens at the presidential level will determine the sort of national character for the entire country, and if you don't vote for Donald Trump, then your entire way of life is gone. I mean, obviously, that's an intense hyperbole, but it strikes a chord with a lot of people. And I feel I'm on the left, a lot of Democrats feel the same way. Now that Donald Trump is president, this is not my country anymore. I don't recognize this country. I mean, think about that. And think about what that is doing to our collective psyche as a nation. So, there's the thought is that if we can let communities have more sense of autonomy, that drains some of these questions out of national politics and lowers the stakes a little bit of these national elections, and also gives people more of a sense of autonomy. Right? I mean, we live in Washington, federal government is right here, but for a lot of folks, it seems like this far distant place, and this is a fundamental aspect of human psychology. We want to feel like we have some control, some autonomy over our own destiny. I think there's an extent to which localism provides us with that, provides us with a sense of independence. I'm a parent, I have two young kids. What they want most of all is to feel like they're in control, they have some sense of autonomy over their own lives. And I think that this is how we all feel. So then the question becomes, and I think this is something that we can talk about, what are the issues where local government can play more of a role, and what are issues where just certain scale questions require them to be decided on a national level. Now, some caveats about localism. One, the turnout at local elections is very low. A study of 144 large U.S. cities found that turnout was 20%. So people are not invested, not paying attention to local government. Now, maybe some of that is they feel that politics only matters at the national level. State people say they like their state governments. They don't know anything about their state governments. So this is generally true in politics. People trust the institutions that they know nothing about. The military is the most trusted institution. Most people don't have any idea how the military operates. Congress is the most closely watched institution. People don't like it at all because they pay attention to it. The other thing, a lot of state elections, are just basically people are just voting for the national party. They're not evaluating local candidates. State policy capacity is especially weak. I mean, we have part-time legislatures where we pay people very little money. They have no staffs, and there's a concern that to devolve power would basically mean to devolve it to people who don't have the sort of energy and time and resources to really pay attention to it, and what winds up happening is just the largest corporations or wealthy folks who want to influence policy influence it. So I think we need to think about policy capacity at the local level too. The optimistic hypothesis is that if more power is devolved to the local level, then people will be more engaged and will local institutions will expand to give people opportunities to participate. And then finally, there is a sort of broader question about the sort of nature of the post-industrialist economy. Now, I was doing a little bit of reading around, and I came across a very interesting piece by Samuel Huntington from 1974, and it was titled, Post-Industrial Politics, How Benign Will It Be? He writes, the question remains how the central institutions of government, which still bear the imprint of the 18th century, will be able to function in this environment. He writes, I think this is an interesting tension. Every form of society needs a certain measure of deference, authority, and hierarchy to function well. Post-industrial society will need these at least as much and perhaps more than its predecessors, yet these are precisely the concepts which seem to be at odds with the values generated by social economic advances of post-industrial society. And what he's talking about is also the rise of post-materialist values, self-expression, individual autonomy. Same time, post-industrial society creates very large-scale, massive, complicated problems that are hard to solve at the local level, at the same time that it also empowers people to feel like they want to take more control over their own destiny. And to me, that is at the fundamental core of the questions that we need to be thinking about. So all right, probably expanded over 5 minutes, so I will shut up and defer to Scott.
Thank you to AEI and to Ryan for having me here today. I'm thrilled to be on the panel with these folks. Mm-hmm. I was reminded when I was in grad school, I took a seminar with William Julius Wilson, who would start by reading some remarks. And the first day of class, he did this, and then he sort of turned to his left And he said, so I just would like to hear what everyone has to say about that. And the person on the left would sort of scramble and, you know, give some incoherent answer. By the time I got around to the person to Wilson's right, you know, they'd be like, well, I have a five-part response to that question. So I'm unfortunately, Yuval and Lee have not followed that path and have articulated some really important thoughts before me. So I should probably say, weirdly, that even though I'm the director of the Social Capital Project, that probably my remarks ought to be construed as just being my own. But I'm going to plug the work of the project, of course. And I think I want to highlight one aspect of our report that is a little bit of a thorny issue, I think, which is the role of affluence in the decline of social capital. Because I think for localism to work, we need strong local institutions and dense social networks. And affluence has really made these less necessary in a sense, and we've responded to that by choosing to invest less in them and to invest in our own happiness as individuals first and foremost. To be clear, I am pro-affluence, and I'm not one of these people who says, you know, we need to reverse the course of capitalism because it's created these problems. I'm big on affluence, but I do think that that there are these tensions nonetheless. So affluence has allowed us to outsource the responsibilities that we used to have toward one another, to outsource them to impersonal, non-local institutions. So think of government, for sure, as we've talked about today. But also just think about things like private insurance, consumer credit, the personal service sector, the educational system. These are all new ways that we can fulfill the needs that we have on a day-to-day basis, where in the past we needed our neighbors to raise our barn, right, and any number of other things that neighbors used to do for each other. In particular, affluence made greater female labor force participation possible by making paid childcare affordable. Again, to be clear, I have a daughter. Even before I had a daughter, I was very much a feminist in this regard. It's a great thing that women have more opportunities than they used to. But it has sort of produced a deficit of social capital as well. There's a line in the report that says that women, you know, mid-20th century weren't only homemakers, they were community makers in a sense. And I think that's a big reason why we have a lot thinner of a civil society today. Women took advantage of new opportunities and men did not pick up the slack, needless to say, in the civil sector. Let's see, affluence made single parenthood more feasible, I think paradoxically, by allowing us to have federal safety nets that very imperfectly could substitute for the things that fathers have traditionally brought to families. Again, not anti-single parenthood, single parenthood myself, but I think these are very real trends that have happened that we've got to grapple with. So we rely less on our neighbors generally and more on our friends. One of the findings of our report was just that we spend less time with our neighbors, but we actually spend more time with our friends. That's also aided by affluence and technology that allows us to connect with friends across the country. I think all this just reflects that this could be my introversion talking, but you know, interacting with people is actually kind of difficult, right? You go on the subway and we're all packed in together, reading our phones or doing our best not to talk to the person next to us, right? I mean, social interaction has costs. It's not easy, and it turns out that we don't actually have to interact that much with people these days, though we don't want to. So I really do think it's important to think about that being behind some of the trends. Now, it's interesting to wonder why we have outsourced so much, if we've outsourced stuff to government, why we've outsourced it to the federal government, because it doesn't seem like that naturally had to be the case. And I think there, you know, just very quickly, you know, the three sort of answers I would give is, you know, one, the Great Depression sort of swamped the states and localities. Two, I think the tumult of the 60s and the civil rights abuses, frankly, in parts of the country for much of the 20th century empowered the federal government to do more. And then I think there's just also differences. Poor states obviously have a vested interest in having the federal government do more and to do some redistribution from rich state to poor states. And I think that it ought to be an important role for the federal government as well. But it doesn't necessarily have to be the case that even if we want to outsource some of these responsibilities to each other, that it has to go to the federal government.
Well, okay. That's all great. We're going to try to just deal with a couple of maybe less, a little more difficult issues in some ways. And I'm going to throw this out to Lee. I also was at New America, which is more center-left. And one of the things that we've tried to do from the beginning of the Center Opportunity Urbanism, when we started on localism about a year and a half ago, was how do we engage people who are on the progressive left? You know, this localism issue has been a traditional conservative issue, but I don't think it's going to get anywhere if people in the center and even to the left see the value. And we had several people at our meeting in Orange County where they were coming from the left, San Francisco people, and I'll get into that issue in a second. But how do we make a case to people in the center and left that this is an issue that should matter to them?
I think by electing Donald Trump president. I've seen, after, among friends on the left, there was sort of this, this moment of horror and shock, and then, oh, now we're all Federalists because California is going to save us. And New York is going to save us. So I think there was sort of a new reality that actually this federalism thing that we didn't like, actually we really like it because it's the one thing that may save us. And California is by itself, I think, would be the sixth largest economy in the world. So that's a lot of bargaining power. And California can in effect set environmental standards for the entire country because. If everybody's going to be producing for the California market, I think for a long time, at least since Obama was elected, there was sort of this assumption on the political left that, well, we're always going to have the presidency because Democrats have a natural advantage in the Electoral College. And I think understanding that Democrats don't have the presidency now and may not, who knows, when they will have it again, that there is a sense that there is an investment in local communities. I mean, there are some who have been making this case for a while. I think most notably Heather Gerken, who said, look, in communities, in cities, in smaller towns or places where people who are minorities at the national level actually can get to set policy at the local level. So I think. My short, glib answer, elect a Republican president and Democrats will come to appreciate federalism is probably the most concise answer to the question.
Yuval, do you have anything to add? Or?
Well, I think that makes a lot of sense. It's, there certainly has been a tradition of progressive federalism and more than that, much more than that, of progressive localism, of an appreciation for the importance of a kind of cultural localism. But obviously, there's no question that on the whole, Democrats are, in our politics, more inclined to use national power, and it takes Republicans controlling Washington to get them to think otherwise. I think the point that Lee makes about the ways in which states with enough bargaining power can affect national policy is very important. California is easily the best example of this. Every child's toy in the United States, if you turn it around, you'll see on the back that it meets the fire safety requirements of the state of California. And Amazon won't sell toys that don't. That basically means one state can have an enormous effect in regulatory terms. This is true in climate with cars. It's true in other ways. I don't think the most important way to think about federalism is how can we shape national policy as a state. I think diversity in policy is actually important in itself. But for progressives who care about that, there's certainly an argument to be made that they have a lot of bargaining power just by virtue of the majorities they have in some states and in most cities.
I mean, the only thing that I would add, I think it is hopeful that there is some support for federalism on the center left now, but I do have very distinct memories of the conversation also popping up after the 2004 election when I think liberals were momentarily stunned that George Bush had defeated Kerry despite all of the things going on in Iraq. So I think we'll see, I guess. That said, Republicans may not be super interested in devolving power if they continue to retain both houses in the presidency, which seems doubtful. But.
I want to just, you know, before we go to the Q&A for the audience, which we're looking forward to, another issue which is not really discussed that much is the power of states over localities. In other words, the idea, yes, you know, let's say you want to devolve power to the states, but what happens when the state is in some senses as authoritarian as anything? I happen to be over 45-year resident of the state of California, you know, we are almost in an Orwellian state at this stage of the game. I mean, in the sense that whether it's the University of California speech codes, and particularly on issues like zoning, housing, which have historically been local issues, that are now being in the control of the state government, and so that we now have, I've had numerous conversations with mayors throughout California who just say, I have no power. Everything is going to be the state government and then the regional agencies that enforce the state government. And given the fact that, you know, a lot of our policies are kind of lunatic, it's particularly hard. And, you know, I live in a small town of 2,500 people. People know each other. We have a problem with something in the community. We go around the corner, we talk to the mayor and ask her what we can do. And instead, we've got this almost impenetrable bureaucracy. But at the same time, just to make the conservatives a little bit uncomfortable, we have a situation in the state of Texas, which is my sort of second home. United Airlines is very much appreciates my career choices. The thing that's really interesting is that then on some states, North Carolina as well, we've had state governments veto and control the policy at the local level, which I think sort of shoots a big hole into the conservative argument. If you're going to have state policies, you know, my sense is let Austin be crazy. If it wants to be crazy, let it be crazy. You know, if Portland wants to ban the private car, well, go see how that works. So what do we do, not just with the federal government, but with state governments which are encroaching on, you know, as the senator was saying, and I think all of you have mentioned, it's really that local government where we actually have some degree of influence. So how do we deal with that state issue? And I'm particularly interested in whether conservatives are uncomfortable with what legislatures like Texas and North Carolina have been doing.
Yeah, no, I think it's a very important issue, and it connects with our partisan politics in an interesting way, because a lot of our major cities in America are run by Democrats, and now the vast majority of our states are run by Republicans. And so you have playing out a kind of reverse federalism debate in some states. You see this very much in Ohio, for example, where the cities want to be free from the states. I think they ought to be, to the extent that you can be. And this differs quite a lot in different places. Where I grew up in New Jersey, localities are incredibly independent, and there's almost literally infinite number of them in New Jersey, little tiny townships. And this creates problems too, and there are ways in which scale can save money and all the rest of it, but I certainly think that if you think about each of the arguments that that Senator Lee laid out and each of the arguments that localists lay out, each of them is also an argument for the local over the state, especially in states where the scale is so immense that, you know, the state of Texas, state of California, these are governments that are governing a society larger than most European countries. And so to think about localism in these places would really mean thinking local.
Yeah, I agree with you all that. If decisions can be made at the local level and they don't impinge on the larger state, and if states want to set their own bathroom laws, if states want to decide whether or not to ban plastic bags, banning cars even, things in which people get to determine their own way of life in their own smaller community that doesn't impinge on the larger states, I don't see any justification for why a larger government should tell a smaller government what to do. But the hard question to ask is then, well, in what are areas where it makes sense to do things at a larger level, either because there's sort of regional planning questions, or they're just sort of bargaining questions, right? You know, that in terms of economic development also, right? I mean, it's very easy for large companies to play localities off against each other, asking for development tax credits, and that winds up just often harming local communities. I don't know what the set of tests are, but you know, it should always be one way or always the other, but you know, I think to the extent that people want to live and feel a sense of autonomy and investment in their community and feel like they can live their values, if it doesn't impinge on the larger states, I think communities should be able to live their values.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because California and Texas are both obviously very big states, and I think bigger places are more diverse places. And I think there's a more general idea that, you know, that's sort of running through Lee's remarks that really connects 2016 in the U.S. to 2016 in the U.K. And Brexit, and which is just that basically people don't want to surrender authority to people who are not like them, right? And so the more you're surrendering authority to a national or a federal government, the more diverse the nation or political union is likely to be, and if the stakes are high, the greater the chances that you are surrendering authority to somebody with very different values than your own. And I think that's truer in large states than it is in small states, if you're a locality looking at the state government. And I think that the combination of centralization and winner take all and diversity is really driving a lot of the movements that we see not just in the United States as well, but in other countries as well.
I do think it's important to see that this relates to one of the arguments against localism that we have to take seriously, which is the danger of, to use an old term, majority tyranny. We like to talk about Tocqueville, and Senator Lee did it very nicely, and Tocqueville has one image of localism in America. But there's another image of localism in America that comes from another person that conservatives love to quote on other subjects, and that's James Madison, who was an ardent enemy of localism. He wanted to let the federal government have a veto over state governments. He mentions in his notes that there were no other supporters for this idea in the Constitutional Convention. But Madison had reasons for this. He had grown up seeing local and state government. His father was a politician in Louisa County in Virginia and at the state capitol. And he had a very low opinion of how state and local government worked. And his basic concern was that majorities at the local level are unstoppable. And his concern on that front was about religious liberty, to some extent about economic majorities. I think that argument has been borne out most in our history on another subject, on the question of race, where there are issues that just simply cannot be left to local majorities. Right. And the biggest challenge to those of us who want to talk about states' rights and local rights has got to be the history of race in America, which offers an argument against localism that cannot be ignored. It maybe can be answered up to a point, but surely it ought to offer a restraint on our enthusiasm about localism that is a permanent fact of life in America.
I think we've got time now to go to the audience. If you have a comment, please ask the question, state your name and affiliation. And you know what? Let's make the questions as opposed to statements. And that way we can get our panelists all engaged. So are there any questions? We have a microphone. So how about this gentleman over here?
Hi, I'm Daniel Butler from University of Maryland, and I'm a fellow resident of, or former resident of Orange County. My question pertains to this to this California question. And how do you deal with the possibility of California kind of throwing its weight around in the country? Should the federal government have a role in kind of tying states like California or Texas's hands? Because that would seem a little contradictory to this kind of theme of localism.
I think it depends on the issue. Right? I think one of the themes that's, that comes out is a sort of universal blanket government, local government should have less, should have more power, isn't very helpful, right? I mean, the question is, what are specific issues, are these issues where the local community can, or the the local state can have autonomy in a way that, you know, doesn't entirely impinge on the rights of minorities, as you've all raised, or sort of undermine sort of larger national unity, then great, go ahead. If either of those two problems arise seriously from local autonomy, then, you know, we should have a larger conversation, I think. I think that's one way to approach it.
Okay. John Solana, independent economist. Senator Lee mentioned the point that the welfare state has crowded out civil society. One part of this is, well, what do you do about that? How can now civil society crowd out the welfare state? And then he did mention subsidiarity, devolving to individuals the responsibilities of things they can control. Is there any way to promote that?
That's a great question.
I think that Republicans have really coalesced, at least in terms of safety net policy, around the idea of maybe coalesced is too strong a word. There's a lot of support in a lot of conservative circles for block granting, sending safety net benefits to the states with fewer strings attached. In 1996, when welfare reform happened, there were a lot of concerns, mostly from the left, that there was going to be a race to the bottom. You still hear claims that a lot of the money is being spent on things that are unrelated to the core purposes, which I think are way overblown, actually. But that's a way to devolve some authority to states anyway, to let 1,000 flowers bloom if it's well evaluated, and figure out what works and what doesn't work. Otherwise, I think we do need to find ways to just get the federal government out. So I'm thinking specifically of marriage promotion programs, which the federal government tried in the early 2000s, and which, you know, were largely unsuccessful. I think in Oklahoma, like, people were happier with their relationships, but no one actually got married more. And that was like the best that could be said for any of them. But there's a program in Jacksonville, Florida, that's being run under the Culture of Freedom Initiative, and that's really succeeding. And the reason that it's succeeding, if you talk to the folks behind it, is that it's heavily focused on church networks and people going to fellow congregants and being like, trying to convince them that marriage is really important and they should work at it, and, you know, maybe would you go to this meeting just this one time, and then, oh, you're coming back next week, right? And the federal marriage promotion just ruled that out completely because of church state issues. There's got to be some way, I think, to allow those sorts of often religious social networks at the local level to work the magic that they do.
And I might add one more thing on this question of means-tested programs. Senator Lee mentioned in his remarks about how means-tested welfare programs disincentivize marriage. And I think there are, for a lot of these programs, there are these sort of crazy asset tests that people have to do, and they have to show how little assets they have. And I mean, the whole way a lot of these programs are structured is just insane. So I think one simpler way is just making a lot fewer of these programs means and asset tests, that just if you're going to provide benefits, they're more universal, I think would help solve some of those problems and also reduce administrative costs as well.
I think the underlying premise of your question is very important, quite apart from where it leads us on specific solutions, which is that the institutions that we wish were still doing this work haven't just been sitting there for 100 years waiting for us to come back. They've withered away. And that means that just rolling back national programs isn't going to be everything you need to do to fill this space with civil society. There has to be, maybe first, a reinvestment of our time and of our energy and of our policy thinking in civil society. There has to be, a kind of institutionalism in how we think about solving problems that is really absent from a lot of public policy on the left and the right, which tends to be highly individualistic, just in different ways. What actually fills the space of civil society, fills the space between the individual and the state, is a set of institutions. And I think across the range of how we think about our society now, we've become very bad at thinking about institutions. And policy thinking is going to have to take that up again. There's a lot to be worked with in the social sciences and a lot to be learned from again or relearned, but it's not what politics does at all. We have in politics a debate between two forms of radical individualism, and it's not a surprise that civil society is weak in this situation.
Well, one more question.
Larry Checo, Checo Communications. We've talked a lot about civil society. What about the role of leadership in this effort for localism? We've already conceded the fact that most people look towards the federal government or pay more attention to the federal government than they do to their own local governments. It doesn't seem like the federal government has been very civil over the last 10 years. It's been a very uncivil occupation up here, and we need to get that straight. Is that do you think there's a role there for people right here in this town to make their efforts better focused so that local governments can do a better job?
Yes. I think there is a way, and Scott suggested this before, where the party in power tends to think in centralized national terms. The party out of power discovers federalism for a while, and also just the civility side of civil society is entirely absent from our national politics just now. Maybe not entirely absent. Senator Lee's an example of it. There are examples on the left and the right, but they certainly don't dominate the tenor of our politics. And, you know, I think, honestly, part of it is a function of the fact that the two parties in different ways have exhausted themselves, have exhausted a way of thinking about public policy rooted in the middle of the 20th century that isn't exactly what we need and isn't really what it would mean to be the left or the right today. And so they have these very abstract arguments. And the notion is always whoever wins the next election will dominate the universe forever. And that's not a very practical way of thinking about policy and politics. And it's not a very practical way to approach solving problems. And so I think some kind of reinvigoration of how we think about public policy, which it seems to me in 21st century America would have to be rooted in federalism in some form, would do a lot of good to both parties, and as a result would help lower the temperature a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think we always talk, there should be more civility in politics. We should have a more civil conversation. And then crickets. And why is that? It's because there are very few incentives to do that, right? We have a very divided country in which we've seen, you know, Democrats have unified government, then it's divided government, then Republicans have unified government, right? So just like a little swing here or a little swing there can totally shape who has unified power. And that means that both parties are engaged in this sort of all-out war to destroy the other side. And because we basically have party coalitions that are 40 years old and have nothing, very little to say to the current moment, it's all about negative partisanship. For Democrats, it's all, you couldn't possibly vote for Republicans. They're evil, evil, evil. For Republicans, you couldn't possibly vote for Democrats. They're evil, evil, evil. Because that's the only way to keep folks on your side voting, is to make it feel like if the other side gets power, then all is lost. And you know, that is, I think, largely grows out of both the sort of centralized power of the presidency, our winner-take-all majoritarian single-member district approach to elections, which I would change and move us towards a more proportional system, but that may be a little too far afield for this conversation. But I think we've got to think about how our institutions and partisan balance have gotten us to this moment, and you know, talking about more civility in Washington is like trying to take buckets to a flood when the levees upstream are totally broken.
On civility, I think that's a tough one. I think as far as more leadership on localism, I think one of the most interesting, I mean, I'm certainly biased in this regard, but I think one of the most interesting developments in Washington in the last few years has been the Reform Conservative movement, which I think is distinctive in seeing a federal role in solving a lot of policies that Republicans maybe haven't given enough attention to in the past, that often involves federalism or state experimentation, for instance. Paul Krugman prematurely eulogized the movement this morning. But the main thing I want to say is I want to just point out the leadership of Senator Mike Lee on this issue.
All right, well, look, I think we're out of time, but this discussion is going to continue, and we really appreciate all of you coming here, and also like to thank our panelists for doing a really great job. Thank you.
You've been listening to the AI Events Podcast. For more information about upcoming events at the American Enterprise Institute, visit www.aei.org/events. See you next time.